Chapter 60. The world, in a word, I can call myself by no other name. I do not say, I am going here, or I am going there. I say nothing at all, I only act. For instance, next week you may find me the guest of a grandee of Spain, or you may find me off for Venice, or flitting toward Dresden. I shall probably go to Egypt presently. Friends will say to friends, he is at the Nile Cataracts, and at that very moment they will be surprised to learn that I'm away off yonder in India somewhere. I am a constant surprise to people. They are always saying, yes, he was in Jerusalem when we heard of him last, but goodness knows where he is now. Presently the grandson rose to leave, discovered he had an appointment with some emperor, perhaps. He did his graces over again. Gripped me with one talon, at arm's length, pressed his hat against his stomach with the other, bent his body in the middle three times, murmuring, pleasure, I'm sure, great pleasure, I'm sure. Wish you much success. Then he removed his gracious presence. It is a great and solemn thing to have a grandfather. I have not purposed to misrepresent this boy in any way, for what little indignation he excited in me soon passed and left nothing behind it but compassion. One cannot keep up a grudge against a vacuum. I have tried to repeat this lad's very words. If I have failed anywhere, I have at least not failed to reproduce the marrow and meaning of what he said. He and the innocent chatterbox whom I met on the Swiss lake are the most unique and interesting specimens of young America I came across during my foreign tramping. I have made honest portraits of them, not caricatures. The grandson of 23 referred to himself 5 or 6 times as an LD traveler, and as many as 3 times with a serene complacency which was maddening, as a an of the world. There was something very delicious about his leaving Boston to her arrowness, unreproved and uninstructed. I formed the caravan in marching order, presently, and after riding down the line to see that it was properly roped together, gave the command to proceed. In a little while the road carried us to open, grassy land. We were above the troublesome forest now, and had an uninterrupted view, straight before us, of our summit, the summit of the Riffelberg. We followed the mule road, a zigzag course, now to the right, now to the left, but always up, and always crowded and incommoded, by going and coming files of reckless tourists who were never, in a single instance, tied together. I was obliged to exert the utmost care and caution, for in many places the road was not 2 yards wide, and often the lower side of it sloped away in slanting precipices 8 and even 9 feet deep. I had to encourage the men constantly, to keep them from giving way to their unmanly fears. We might have made the summit before night, but for a delay caused by the loss of an umbrella. I was allowing the umbrella to remain lost, but the men murmured, and with reason, for in this exposed region we stood in peculiar need of protection against avalanches. So I went into camp, and detached a strong party to go after the missing article. The difficulties of the next morning were severe, but our courage was high, for our goal was near. At noon we conquered the last impediment, we stood at last upon the summit, and without the loss of a single man except the mule, that ate the glycerin. Our great achievement was achieved, the possibility of the impossible was demonstrated, and Harris and I walked proudly into the great dining room of the Riffelberg Hotel, and stood our alpenstocks up in the corner. Yes, I had made the grand ascent, but it was a mistake to do it in evening dress. The plug hats were battered, the swallow tails were fluttering rags, mud added no grace, the general effect was unpleasant and even disreputable. There were about 75 tourists at the hotel, mainly ladies, and little children, and they gave us an admiring welcome which paid us for all our privations and sufferings. The ascent had been made, and the names and dates now stand recorded on a stone monument there to prove it to all future tourists. I boiled a thermometer, and took an altitude, with a most curious result. The summit was not as high as the point on the mountainside, where I had taken the first altitude. Suspecting that I had made an important discovery, I prepared to verify it. There happened to be a still higher summit, called the Gorner Grat, above the hotel, and notwithstanding the fact that it overlooks a glacier from a dizzy height, and that the ascent is difficult and dangerous, I resolved to venture up there and boil a thermometer. So I sent a strong party, with some borrowed hose, in charge of two chiefs of service, to dig a stairway in the soil all the way up, and this I ascended, roped to the guides. This breezy height was the summit proper, so I accomplished even more than I had originally purposed to do. This foolhardy exploit is recorded on another stone monument. I boiled my thermometer, and sure enough, this spot, which purported to be 2,000 feet higher than the locality of the hotel, turned out to be 9,000 feet lower. Thus the fact was clearly demonstrated that, above a certain point, the higher a point seems to be, the lower it actually is. Our ascent itself was a great achievement, but this contribution to science was an inconceivably greater matter. Caviller's object that water boils at a lower and lower temperature the higher and higher you go, and hence the apparent anomaly. I answer that I do not base my theory upon what the boiling water does, but upon what a boiled thermometer says. You can't go behind the thermometer. I had a magnificent view of Monte Rosa, and apparently all the rest of the Alpine world, from that high place. All the circling horizon was piled high with a mighty tumult of snowy crests. One might have imagined he saw before him the tented camps of a beleaguering host of Brobdingnagians. But lonely, conspicuous, and superb, rose that wonderful upright wedge, the Matterhorn. Its precipitous sides were powdered over with snow, and the upper half hidden in thick clouds which now and then dissolved to cobweb films, and gave brief glimpses of the imposing tower, as through a veil. A little later the Matterhorn took to himself the semblance of a volcano. He was stripped naked to his apex around this circled vast wreaths of white cloud which strung slowly out, and streamed away slantwise toward the sun, a 20-mile stretch of rolling and tumbling vapor, and looking just as if it were pouring out of a crater. Later again, one of the mountain sides was clean and clear, and another side densely clothed from base to summit in thick smoke-like cloud which feathered off, and flew around the shaft's sharp edge like the smoke around the corners of a burning building. The Matterhorn is always experimenting, and always gets up fine effects too. In the sunset, when all the lower world is palled in gloom, it points toward heaven out of the pervading blackness like a finger of fire. In the sunrise, well, they say it is very fine in the sunrise. 2. Note. I had the very unusual luck to catch one little momentary glimpse of the Matterhorn wholly unencumbered by clouds. I leveled my photographic apparatus at it without the loss of an instant, and should have got an elegant picture if my donkey had not interfered. It was my purpose to draw this photograph all by myself for my book, but was obliged to put the mountain part of it into the hands of the professional artist, because I found I could not do landscape well. Authorities agree that there is no such tremendous aid of snowy alpine magnitude, grandeur, and sublimity to be seen from any other accessible point as the tourist may see from the summit of the Riffelberg. Therefore, let the tourist rope himself up and go there, for I have shown that with nerve, caution, and judgment, the thing can be done. I wish to add one remark, here in parentheses, so to speak, suggested by the word snowy, which I have just used. We have all seen hills and mountains, and levels with snow on them, and so we think we know all the aspects and effects produced by snow. But indeed we do not until we have seen the Alps. Possibly mass and distance add something, at any rate, something is added. Among other noticeable things, there is a dazzling, intense whiteness about the distant alpine snow, when the sun is on it, which one recognizes as peculiar, and not familiar to the eye. The snow which one is accustomed to has a tint to it. Painters usually give it a bluish cast, but there is no perceptible tint to the distant alpine snow when it is trying to look its whitest. As to the unimaginable splendor of it, when the sun is blazing down on it, well, it simply is unimaginable. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.